This series contains adult language and descriptions of graphic violence throughout. Listener discretion is advised.
And I remember his funeral, he was getting buried. They actually had to post police at his gravesite because we were told the satanic cults that they were worried that they were going to come try to take his body. And again, we had to get briefed on all these things because if they wanted to come and get the body, if they actually got to the gravesite and you interfered, they would kill you. You know, this has happened, I guess, in other places where they come to try to take the body. And because they believe that, you know, the soul of the devil lives within Tommy and they want to recover that. So, yeah, it was pretty intense. You know, a victory for the devil.
In the 18 months leading up to the Sullivan murder-suicide, there had been a dramatic increase in incidents involving the occult and satanic worship across the state of New Jersey. In Middlesex County, four high school seniors weren't allowed to attend graduation with their classmates due to an investigation regarding what was alternately labeled as fascination with or worship of a demonic creature that the four friends claimed spoke to them and gave them commands. It should be made known that these kids were lifelong friends who grew up playing the 80s board game Dungeons and Dragons. It was never determined if they were joking or if their devotion to this creature was genuine. Tommy Sullivan also grew up playing Dungeons and Dragons. I'm Brandon Morgan, and this is The Devil Within.
You can run on for a long time, run for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gonna cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down.
This is episode 2. Paradise Lost. In South Jersey, there were a handful of reports concerning possible covens of Satanists deep in the Pine Barrens, out of reach of law enforcement and locals who might object to their methods of worship. It was never figured out if the cloaked figures in the woods were actual theistic Satanists, the type who firmly believed that Satan is an actual being that resides in a separate plane of existence and can be summoned into this one. Or the more casual, atheistic Satanists, who are in it mostly for the pageantry and the possibility of sex in the woods with a masked partner. Nearly all Satanists who are anonymously interviewed fall into the mostly curious and far less aggressive atheistic category. And they were nearly all between the ages of 25 and 45, college-educated, middle-class, white, law-abiding citizens. There were exactly zero reports of any Satanists who were children of or around Tommy's age on law enforcement radar anywhere in the state of New Jersey. There was, however, growing concern statewide regarding youth consumption of what was deemed dangerous music. This battle against suggestive lyrics was championed by future Second Lady of the United States, Tipper Gore. It was Mrs. Gore, along with the wives of three other prominent politicians, who began the Parents Music Resource Center, the PMRC, an organization that successfully lobbied Congress for the rights of parents to have greater knowledge of the content of the music they were buying for their children. Specifically, material that was sexually explicit, contained foul language, or could introduce ideas of violence or compel someone to incite violence. Despite cries of censorship from every corner of the music industry, the PMRC was successful in that all music released after 1986 that contained lyrics that were considered inappropriate received a parental advisory sticker, clearly visible on its packaging. Another pebble in the shoe of the defenders of the status quo was the unlikely and unexplained spike in popularity of a book that was published over 15 years prior, The Satanic Bible. In 1969, an unknown writer named Anton LaVey authored a highly controversial book outlining the tenets, philosophies, and history of Satanism. Although not wildly popular at its release, it has to date been translated into 7 languages and been through over 30 printings. Suspected to be at least partly a work of plagiarism, it was nonetheless popular with certain groups: occultists, religious historians, and of course, Satanists. Now, in 1988, the human race was still a few years away from the information age. There was no such thing as going viral. Back then, it took much, much longer for an idea to spread than it does today. Of course, there was the nightly news, MTV, and magazines and newspapers to spread the word regarding current events, fads, disasters, and other vital information. But if it was an idea that was decidedly out of the mainstream, or even more, an idea that couldn't be openly spoken about, then the word spread at a snail's pace, if at all. And yet, seemingly overnight, copies of the Satanic Bible were disappearing off the shelves of bookstores and public libraries, mostly out of interest in a growing movement that was very, very taboo. But also in an attempt to save the book from being destroyed by some communities who were suddenly living in a state of confused fear and sought to relieve that fear somewhat by abolishing what they believed to be one of the prime movers of their discontent, a book. So until that night in January of 1988, there had only been tangential connections between satanic worship and criminal activity among juveniles. A few scattered cases of youth gone wrong, but nothing violent. Some reports of people gathering in the woods wearing strange costumes, but again, nothing criminal. Yes, there were some legitimate concerns regarding some of the more incendiary heavy metal music that kids were listening to, but rarely had there been any connection made between suggestive lyrics and criminal activity. But the Sullivan case had all of it. All of the markers, all the missed signals, all the hidden fears of parents and communities, all of the "it could never happen here's," all of it. Tommy had been exposed to the occult and was just impressionable enough for it to take hold in a way that quickly led to obsession. His tastes in music took a radical turn to the most extreme heavy metal bands whose music he could get his hands on. He became argumentative and occasionally combative with his parents. He had at least one completely new friend that he spent most of his time with, and much of that time was spent out of the house. Where? Investigators would later learn that there were sightings of a teenage boy attending satanic rituals in the woods on the edge of town. And in the end, it all added up to a terrible murder-suicide. A boy murdered his mother and then mutilated himself all alone in the woods. And it would have been worse but for the smoke alarm. The smoke alarm, by the way, that was activated by a fire Tommy set using pages torn out of the Satanic Bible. This is the mayor of Jefferson Township, Eric Wilsusen.
Being the mayor wasn't exactly like a lifelong dream. It probably wasn't really on my radar. I had worked in the police department for 31 years. I love my community. My wife and I are very active in the community. We're involved in many different aspects. So I have a genuine love for my community. I was about 25, 26 years old. I was working with a good friend of mine, Bart McConley. He was actually the first officer on the scene. And I think I was over in the Lake Opacon section at the time, and that happened in our White Rock section in the Oak Ridge side of town. So I wasn't the first responding officer. I had later come on scene to help with a search, but we'll talk about that. But I remember Bart McConley being the first officer on scene, and I remember him telling me later on, you know, when he got there, and it was the father who found his wife murdered in the basement. And I mean, it was a pretty horrific scene, and something obviously I'd never dealt with. I mean, I'm a brand new police officer, you're out of the academy. Bart, my friend Bart Conley, he came on just before I did, so he maybe had less than 2 years on the job. He actually went down, saw the body, and went outside and threw up.
And so the satanic panic reached a fever pitch. Schools were cautioned to be on the lookout for any suspicious activity. Reading materials were closely monitored. Music was censored to the point that anything that was even remotely controversial was confiscated and destroyed. I was a freshman in high school that year. And the differences between the first half of the year before Christmas break and the second half of the year was extreme. However, the influence of the Sullivan case was most strongly felt in two main areas. The first was law enforcement, because there was now a threat to the public safety erupting from a new and mysterious wellspring.
We actually had to go through a training after this to learn more about Satanism. And I remember his funeral, he was getting buried. They actually had to post police at his gravesite because we were told the satanic cults, that they were worried that they were going to come try to take his body. And again, we had to get briefed on all these things because if they wanted to come and get the body, like if they actually got to the gravesite and you interfered, they would kill you. You know, this has happened, I guess, in other places where they come to try to take the body. And because they believe that, you know, the soul of the devil lives within Tommy and they want to recover that. So, yeah, it was pretty intense. At that time, yeah, that these cults may come back and try to take his body. This is like, you know, a victory for the devil.
And the second was domestic life. For that now required a re-examination from terrified parents who were suddenly forced to accept that their children could murder them. When investigators learned about the rather sudden and violent transformation that Tommy had gone through, their main question was how. They knew why he had done it based on the writings he had left behind. But how had he come to such a violent end? What were the actual influencers that steered him to such darkness? Staying for a moment with Tommy's newfound interest in Satanism, that was the easiest how for detectives to answer. Also the hardest to accept. But the rest of the hows would require some digging. As Jefferson Township was trying to pick up the pieces in the aftermath of the events of January 8th, the town was briefly and suddenly thrust into the national spotlight. Major news outlets across the country carried the story as well as dozens of newspapers and magazines, culminating with the investigative journalist and media personality, Geraldo Rivera, coming to town to do a story on the Sullivan case and to raise awareness, to sound an alarm of sorts, about the rising threat of violence due to the moral corruption of the youth of America.
The Investigative News Group presents the Geraldo Rivera Special. Devil worship, exposing Satan's underground.
It's teenagers who are most likely to fall under the spell of this jumble of dark, violent emotions called Satanism, and in some cases, to be driven into committing terrible deeds. How could this happen here to a nice boy from a good Catholic school and a fine middle-class family? Father LaBar, you investigate these cases for the Catholic Church. Is it the Church's position that demonic possession is possible?
It certainly is. There have been many cases down through the centuries, many in our own decade, for example, of where the devil has actually possessed people and caused them to do many strange things.
So you believe it's possible?
I believe not only is it possible, it is a reality.
If it happened in nowhere, New Jersey, it could happen in your town, too. A town hall meeting was held to address questions from a deeply concerned community. The mayor, the county prosecutor, the chief of police, and lead investigator were made available to offer what they could to calm shaky nerves and provide some answers.
At our high school, we had to have two sessions that hold 600 people. It was an overflow crowd the first night just to talk about, you know, the whole incident and, you know, what had happened. We brought in people who were experts in Satanism to talk about it. The area priests were involved. Basically overcrowded, we had to have a second night.
At one point, an exasperated dad stood up and demanded to know how a kid like Tommy could even get exposed to something like satanic worship.
The Catholic Church is really, you know, they believe in the good and evil and God and the devil. And, you know, I mean, churches all over the area were having open, you know, to talk about this.
The answer was a difficult pill for the gathered to swallow. You see, Tommy Sullivan was your typical American Irish Catholic teenager in New Jersey, which meant he was exposed to Catholicism on a daily basis. His week consisted of Catholic school, taught by priests and nuns Monday through Friday, where, in addition to math, science, and history, he was taught the Stations of the Cross, the Passion, Revelations, Eternal Damnation, Archangels, and importantly, the Antichrist, that original defiant youth cast out of heaven, banished from paradise for daring to disobey his superior. Then there was, of course, church on Sunday at St. Thomas's, where Tommy served as an altar boy under the tutelage of Father Fitzpatrick, where he was again assaulted with images and stories of powerful evil forces engaged in a constant battle with the better angels of the Christian Bible. But that's not all. For Tommy and others like him, there was also a Saturday commitment to the church, the Confraternity of Christian Doctrine, or CCD. That was an additional 3 hours out of every week dedicated to becoming a better Catholic by learning exactly what to be scared of. So, every day, every single day, brought demands, expectations, and restrictions on the soul of an impressionable young man who, for whatever reason, finally chose not to fear the Antichrist and his ruinous influence, but to embrace it. Indeed, he chose to identify with the defiant nature of the demons of hell and be counted among their number.
Like, wow, is the devil really at work here? Again, going back to what I said earlier about, you know, how brutal he murdered his mother. How do you murder your mother? Bad enough you hit her over the head with an object, but then just to bludgeon her to death and then to take his own life like he did. It was just a very brutal scene all around. And you have to say to yourself, what possesses somebody to do that? And like I said, in the Catholic Church, they believe the devil really took him over.
In the silence that befell the crowd in the wake of the mayor's troubling answer, one can imagine the confusion that must have hung there like a phantom, a deep and terrifying confusion that strained the limits of human reason. Were they supposed to accept the notion that the Catholic Church and its teachings, the very institution that they were brought up to believe would provide a cocoon of protection around their children as it had them, could instead be the instrument of their own destruction? That Tommy Sullivan's introduction into the world that would intrigue, consume, and ultimately destroy him was preached from the pulpit and taught in his classrooms. So it could be argued that Tommy was a powder keg of teen rebellion awaiting a spark. And what exactly was that spark to be? The answer to that question would take investigators down some dark roads, only to end up surprisingly close to home. Detective Hart was a dedicated professional, talented, curious, and thorough. Although it would have been incredibly easy to conclude that Tommy was the killer and acted alone, based solely on the evidence collected within 2 hours of the commission of the crime, Detective Hart nonetheless conducted his investigation as he would any other. Yes, the blood smear near the ceiling didn't quite fit the narrative he was piecing together, and the wounds to Tommy's wrist and neck seemed extraordinarily severe to be self-inflicted. But those were questions for the forensics team and medical examiner to answer. His questions were more fundamental. Motive, opportunity, murder weapon. The process of ruling out possible suspects based on alibi or access, until all other possibilities fall away, and left standing in the cold light of discovery was the only person who could have possibly committed the crime. And the answer was Tommy Sullivan. The suicide note spelled it out. Further, the contract with the demon of hell found in the getaway car, together with the satanic Bible found in the living room, cemented the suspicion that the occult was in some major way the inspiration for the murder-suicide. Did it bother Detective Hart or any of the other investigators that Tommy's dad, Thomas Sr., took his remaining son, Brian, and almost immediately after the funeral, moved to Florida without informing any of the surviving family or the local police? Or that Thomas Sr. was remarried within a year. He did nothing illegal. It just seemed, some would argue, in poor taste. But it did fuel the rumor that it was Thomas Sr. and not young Tommy who actually did the killings. Even investigators had to admit that the two outstanding questions in the case, the blood smear and the exaggerated wounds on Tommy, would be satisfied if indeed Thomas Sr. was involved. But the evidence didn't back it up. And Mr. Sullivan was cleared. In the months following the crimes, Detective Hart was sent to several police conventions with keynote addresses concerning criminal and homicidal youths.
In talking with Paul Hart, and he had done a number of, he flew all over the country after this. I think he went to Australia to do an interview on this. I mean, this really rocked not just our community, but nationwide. This got nationwide attention just because of the satanic overtones that were a part of this, the references.
Hart would always stand and ask a question. Could they shed any light on teenage, ritualistic, occult-inspired murder-suicides. I mean, really? Why on earth would you want to know about that? Was generally the response his question would receive. Then he would introduce himself and where he was from, and murmurs would spread through the convention hall, murmurs of recognition and curiosity. Invariably, Detective Hart would take over as keynote speaker. He would be peppered with questions, generally related to the nature of the boy's introduction and exposure to Satanism, and more urgently, what signs were missed by everybody. Oftentimes, Detective Hart felt that the questions stemmed less from a desire to be better cops and more from parents who were scared of their teenagers.
You know, hit her over the head with a barbell, knocked her out, so there was no real struggle, and then proceeds to stab her, you know, dozens of times, killing her. He tries to set the house on fire to kill the rest of the family, and he takes off.
And the scariest aspect of the case was, and will always be, how quickly Tommy went from altar boy to satanic murderer. There were whispers among the faithful about demonic possession, for by now, the details of the case had leaked and the small town gossip mill had gone into overdrive, especially concerning the aspects of the case that were deemed unexplainable. People, for the most part, either believed it was something otherworldly or that the dad did it. It was just too much for some people to accept that they might be in danger in their own homes, from within their own homes. So, the devil made him do it, quite literally. Or his father is the real killer, and now he's down in sunny Florida laughing at all these small-town cops. But the investigators, in their minds, found the killer. But sometimes that isn't enough. This case required more. It required blame. 14-year-old boys aren't born with a desire to murder their families. Sure, it's a tough age, but come on. This wasn't some flash of anger, I wish you were dead teenage temper tantrum. Tommy wrote about it. He drew pictures. He left a suicide note. He authored a contract between himself and the great demon of hell that called for his life and the lives of his family members.
He had a picture book he liked to draw. I remember this. If you flip through the pages, you would see Mickey Mouse and cartoon characters. And as you flip through, now you're starting to see pentagrams and, you know, pictures of horned men. And all of a sudden, you see this transformation of he went from light to dark. And so that was pretty intense to think about, you know, how this kid would go from one extreme to the other. And supposedly he became very obsessed with Satanism, started reading books on it. If I remember right, they found a letter to the greatest demon of hell and basically saying how he killed his mother and now he can be in one with the devil and this and that. So that really rocked the church.
But he was just a kid, a child, really. So who could be blamed for this? The investigators, after the murder case was closed, received a new mandate. Find out what in the hell happened to Tommy Sullivan in the 6 weeks leading up to the murder. It doesn't seem long enough to bring about the drastic change that so obviously occurred, but in reality, it was a lifetime. Given the media attention surrounding the case, investigators found it increasingly difficult to find any solid leads. People just didn't want to talk about it in any sober, reasonable way. The loudest voices willing to discuss the case were either looking for attention or looking to draw attention to the more fringe ideas regarding the crime. It was the dad who was now on the run and just waiting for the heat to die down so he could do it again. I mean, he's probably done it before, right? Or it was a classic case of demonic possession and the church was covering it up like it's covered up so many other scandals over the centuries. But the first real break in the case of why did Tommy Sullivan do this came in the form of Tommy's 8th grade history teacher. At the request of the Archdiocese of New Jersey, we've agreed not to use his real name. So for the purposes of our story, we'll call him Father Brian Cavanaugh. Brian Cavanaugh grew up on a farm in rural Pennsylvania in a strict Catholic household. His parents were both teachers who instilled in their son a devotion to God and a love of learning. Brian knew from a young age what his calling was to be, to serve the Lord and his fellow man through the teachings of Jesus Christ. His parents couldn't have been prouder or more supportive. After graduation from college with a degree in theology, he went on to earn a master's degree in European history. His ultimate goal was the Jesuit priesthood, which takes many years and requires many steps of education and indoctrination within the Catholic Church. For Brian, it was worth it. The Jesuits are the scholarly, scientific, endlessly curious branch of the Church, and admission into their ranks was all Brian had ever hoped for. One of the stages of study on the road to Jesuit priesthood is called regency, where a candidate is engaged in his ministry full-time as a teacher in a secondary school. And this is where Father Brian comes into the picture, a young, idealistic academic with a desire to enlighten, educate, and challenge the younger generation. So it came to pass that Father Brian, relying on the worldly instruction of his Jesuit masters, offered to his eighth grade students a Thanksgiving break assignment that would have a terrible and lasting effect on a town, a family, and one boy in particular. The assignment was simple enough, even though at the time it was very controversial to some faculty, and especially to more than a few parents. However, Father Brian's status as a future Jesuit allowed him more room than most to broaden his curriculum, and subsequently, the school supported him. That November at Reverend Brown Middle School saw a promising young teacher introduce a brand new topic to the eighth grade class, religions of the world. This may seem a strange topic for a Catholic school, but not for a Jesuit, and not for a teacher interested in preparing his students for life outside the Catholic stronghold of Morris County, New Jersey. Each student was assigned a different, unfamiliar religion to write a paper on, complete with details and commentary. We can assume all the major religions were covered, from Judaism to Hinduism, Islam to Buddhism, Mormonism, you name it. Unfortunately, there are many, many details we don't know regarding specific assignments. We don't know if the students were assigned religions at random, if they were assigned specifically to each student, or if they could choose their own. What we do know is that Tommy Sullivan was not supposed to do a report on Satanism. And that fact, that the report on Satanism was given to a classmate, is very important, as it introduces a new character to our story. But more on that later. For now, as far as we can tell, Tommy's assignment was on Mormonism. We don't know Tommy's feelings on that particular faith. Either he never wrote the paper, he destroyed it in the fire, or it was lost in some other way. What is clear is that this is where it all began to change for Tommy. This was the beginning of the transformation. By all accounts, prior to Thanksgiving of 1987, Tommy Sullivan was a great kid, scholar athlete, altar boy, no trouble at home or at school, ever. But he was just 6 short weeks away from the unthinkable. So what happened? Let's assume for a moment that students were allowed to choose the topics for their papers. That would make sense in that if a student wanted to write about Satanism, he or she would have to lobby the teacher to be allowed to cover so controversial a subject. But that's where things begin to click into place. Events that otherwise would never come to pass suddenly find just the right environment and poof, they exist. In this case, it was a too progressive for his own good teacher combined with a curious student who had heard the whispers of a rising fringe movement. And before they knew it, an eighth grade boy was writing a paper on Satanism. But remember, it wasn't Tommy Sullivan. Juvenile records being what they are, we'll never know the name of the boy who wrote that particular paper. Referred to as Juvenile 1 in the police reports, for our purposes, we'll call him Lance. That Thanksgiving, Tommy and Lance became friends. We know very little about Lance, and most of what you'd hear would be speculation. But with a little digging and connecting of dots, we can paint something of a clear picture. There's a very good chance that Lance's family wasn't Catholic. He may, in fact, have been from one of the handful of Jewish families in the area. That wouldn't have been unheard of. Some parents would rather send their children to any school rather than the local public school. Also, not being Catholic would also fit with his choice of essay topics, Satanism. Yes, it would also fit nicely with a rebellious religious teen raging against what he's been force-fed all his life. Either way, Lance was to write about Satanism, and this would be Tommy's introduction to the dark world of the occult. One of the many things we don't know about Lance is how he was introduced to Satanism, or when his fascination began. Lance had an older sister who was in high school and dated older men, and it's been theorized that it may have been one of those boyfriends who first exposed Lance to the occult. We do know that Lance was also a wrestler, and that he and Tommy became close friends and study partners. On school days, for instance, there was an hour between the end of classes and the start of wrestling practice. In all probability, Lance and Tommy spent that hour together at the library with the rest of the athletes, especially during Thanksgiving break while they worked on their reports. It was after Thanksgiving, when classes resumed, that the friendship grew. Besides sharing an interest in wrestling, Lance is suspected to have represented a way of life that Tommy was unfamiliar with. A level of freedom that wasn't permitted in the Sullivan household, the complete lack of religious devotion, tons of personal time on weekends, and perhaps most attractive, an interest in and access to various materials related to the occult. There were books and other literature, definitely, and maybe information regarding actual satanic rituals in the woods on the edge of town. After all, every kid across three counties in North Jersey knew about Clinton Road and the rumors about ghosts and monsters and devil worshippers in the woods. But someone Tommy's age had probably never been there. Pausing for a moment to further examine the general state of Tommy's life and to fully understand the drastic changes that occurred between Thanksgiving and January 8th. There were specific events, physical and emotional changes, and most importantly, a massive ideological shift. Granted, a paradigm shift in ideology is a lot to ask and expect from a teenage kid. But remember, we're dealing with a boy who was surrounded by, submerged in, and being crushed under the weight of Catholicism and its expectations on a daily basis. So you can imagine how attractive an alternative to that lifestyle might be. Enter Satanism. It was taboo. It was dangerous. It was rebellious. And so far as any investigator could determine, Tommy didn't believe a word of it. At least not at first. By all accounts, he was a serious skeptic just along for the ride. Like the kid who knows professional wrestling is fake, but watches with his friends just to fit in. The investigation revealed that, at least to the people close to him, his interest in Satanism was superficial, just something to rattle some cages. He probably had genuine interest in some of the music, but all the other stuff, the rituals, the chanting, the costumes, that was all for show. But then something changed. Sometime around Christmas of 1987, Tommy withdrew almost completely. When he did speak to his parents, he was dismissive, argumentative, and combative. He started missing wrestling practice, and when he was there, he became hyper-aggressive on the mat and was subsequently benched. It was around this period in our timeline, late December of 1987, that the first mention is made that draws a direct connection between Tommy Sullivan and Clinton Road. That connection is important because it links a drastic behavioral change with Tommy's presence at a new and unique location. And so, it can be concluded that the wicked transformation undergone by Tommy didn't play out over 6 weeks, as originally thought, but over less than 2 weeks. And it seemed to begin after Tommy visited Clinton Road.
Go tell that long-tongued preacher!
The Devil Within is a Cavalry Audio production, written and directed by Brandon Morgan. Original score by Monkey Mind Music Group. Original music by Bruce Witkin. Executive produced by Keegan Rosenberger and Dana Brunetti. For Cavalry Audio, I'm Brandon Morgan.